If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
A mentor told me once that these people, these institutional investors, these groups that you were to, if you were to partner with one of them on like an allocator fund basis or doing a 90-10 JV with a group like this, these people are not your friends. These are not gentle people. They will rip your face off for a basis point.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Brian Adams is the president and founder of Excelsior Capital, where he spearheads the investor relations and capital markets arms of the firm. He has 10 years of experience in real estate private equity and has advanced knowledge and best practices for strategic real estate investing. Prior to forming Excelsior Capital, Brian co-founded Priam Properties, an institutional real estate private equity sponsor in 2010, and provided leadership and direction for the firm in connection with capital markets, investment management, and investor relations. Hey, Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Man, it's great. Always great to have a fellow Tennessean, of course, on the show as well. You've got a diverse background that I'm excited to hear about. You know, the typical flow of the show is where'd you start, where are you now, and how did you get there? Maybe we can get just kind of a truncated version of that. And then maybe if you can tell us what it was like to be an institutional real estate private equity sponsor, and then kind of how you transitioned into what, I know it's a lot all at once I'm throwing at you, but then how you transitioned to what you're doing now. We'd just kind of love to hear that background.
Yeah, let's do it. So very briefly, I'm a New Yorker who married a Nashville girl. So married a Tennessean, and very much kind of non-negotiable that we would move to Nashville once
we got. It works that way.
Yeah, very, very much so. Son-in-law kind of town. So my wife's family has a family office here. That's how I got into the commercial real estate business. I did practice law for a number of years, so I'm a recovering attorney. And I got into the institutional space because my partner, who's also a New Yorker who married a Nashville girl, had a background working with institutional groups out of New York City. We kind of started in the fund business, right? Raising commingled blind pool capital. And it was fine. We raised quite a bit of capital. We did a lot of deals, but at some point in the journey realized that it wasn't probably the right fit for us as an investor in terms of how we wanted to run the company, how we thought about growing the company, and frankly, just having the right capital partnership. So about 5 years ago, I pivoted towards a direct syndication model where we raise capital on a deal-by-deal basis from a network of high-net-worth individuals, family offices, and independent RIA, kind of private wealth management, multifamily offices, all taxable investors. Right. And so that's where I've been focused really for the last 5 or 6 years.
Right, right. And would you say your background in the private equity space kind of set you up for success in what you're doing now?
It certainly taught me a lot of lessons about the groups that I did not want to work with on the capital side, which I think is just as useful as knowing what you want to do, right? Because it can save you a lot of time and energy. And I'm sure you have a lot of folks on the show, or you know, real estate sponsors or GPs like myself who, they think that institutional private equity fund or that capital is going to be a turnkey event for them that will open up all the other doors, right? It'll be kind of the golden chalice that will lead them down the path to success.
Sure.
And the reality is it's very expensive capital, both from an economic standpoint, but also from an emotional psychic standpoint, because these people don't really care about being your friend. They don't care about the relationship. It's purely a numbers game for them. And when you take a step back and look at the landscape of institutional private equity, roughly 85% of all of the capital raised for private equity real estate over the last cycle has gone to 5 firms.
Did you say that again?
85% of all the institutional investment capital that's been raised for private equity real estate has gone to 5 firms.
5 firms. Okay.
So you're talking about the KKRs, the Blackstones, the Carlyles. Right. Of the world.
Right.
And they have various buckets, right? So that can be an expansive, like Blackstone's got their opportunity fund, their income fund, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But when you think about that number, that leaves 15% of the pie. And when institutional allocators, so if you're talking to a pension fund or an endowment or a large sovereign wealth fund, right, an institutional allocator of capital, when you talk to them, you've got to realize that they are benchmark peer to peer. So if everybody's giving money to Blackstone, that's cool because they're not going to look different than their peers. But for them to go out on the risk spectrum and start a new relationship with a new investment partner, they don't get paid a lot more based on the return profile, right? They're in the business of not losing money. And so it's just a very difficult space to break into. And also you've got to realize they typically want to write a $25 to $50 million check per fund, but they don't want to be more than 5 or 10% of your fund vehicle. So you really have to go out with a $350 to $500 million fund vehicle with a straight face in order to get these people to pay attention to you. And you probably need to have 3 to 5% of a commitment from the general partner to participate in that fund vehicle.
Right. And so then even if you're building that fund vehicle, you then have to have assets that you're purchasing that are commensurate to that size of that fund, which then I'm sure finding just the assets that make sense to buy inside of that fund are even a challenge in their own right.
Yeah. So two things that are big takeaways. One, it's a rich person's game, right? 3 to 5% of a $350 to $500 million fund is not chump change. That's real money. And so you need to be, you know, already arrived to participate in that game. And two is exactly your point. Once you are deploying a $500 million fund and you want to probably have 10 plus assets in the fund and you're going to use leverage, yeah, you're going to suffer from style drift because you can no longer take down a $10 or $20 million deal.
Right.
You're looking at $75 to $150 million opportunities. And once you get into that, that's a big boy world. There's really just not a lot of deal flow there. And that's why you see cap rates be, you know, so tight in that window. And people start going out on the risk spectrum. They start going on the leverage spectrum. It's very challenging. It's just a different ecosystem of investments than working with individuals and families on the private side.
That's interesting in that I bet even just the stress level alone from dealing with that sort of institutional investor, I mean, that'd be enough. I think just hearing your story there, I just hear lots of tense conversations and lots of like, hey man, where's our money? What are we, is it being deployed? Is it being, you know, what are we putting this into? Go, go, go.
I had a mentor tell me once that these people, these institutional investors, these groups that you were, if you were to partner with one of them, on like an allocator fund basis or doing a 90-10 JV with a group like this, these people are not your friends. These are not gentle people.
Right.
They will rip your face off for a basis point. That's why they've been able to achieve what they've been able to achieve, right? I mean, they have sharp elbows. And so if you want to participate in that world, that's fine, but you need to go in eyes wide open. Sure. And I think oftentimes I hear groups that say, oh, we're going to partner with a big name like Blackstone or KKR, Carlyle, whatever the name is. And I oftentimes am like, man, you're better off just grinding it out, continue to raise friends and family money, because you're actually going to be able to participate in those deals. You're actually going to be able to make some fees on those deals. And even if you might have some awkward Thanksgiving dinners, but these people are not going to come after your house.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's interesting. That's interesting. So you said now you work with a lot of family offices. And I'm sure, you know, as you get into larger family offices, you might have some of those similar dynamics, but it sounds like that's a much more pleasant experience for you as a capital raiser.
Yeah, I think it has to do with the personality, your investment thesis, and just what your comfort level is. And what I tell people oftentimes is I think family office is a misused word many times. It doesn't necessarily mean a set amount of zeros in your bank account. It's a mindset. It is a mindset where you've created a small business for the purpose of generating enough return so that you can maintain a quality of life and a cost of living across an exponentially growing family base. And so they have a long-term time horizon. They are trying to reduce their tax burden, and they're hoping to maintain that quality of life across, you know, inflation plus, you know, two kids. And so it's just a different way of thinking about things. And it resonates with the type of deals that we do and how we structure our own investments and the type of people that we'd like to work with. It's not for everybody. I also think it's kind of one of these worlds where people think, oh, I just want to crack into that family office investment space. Well, it's like most things. It's not that simple. They get pitched a lot.
Sure.
You need to understand kind of what they're hoping to achieve and execute on before you can even step into that room, because you probably only get one shot with these people. but it's worked for us. And we're very fortunate to have some great partners.
Do you also work with individual investors?
Yeah, we have a very broad range. So we have high net worth individuals or families. We have some legacy investors that, you know, participate on a much smaller level, but on a percentage basis, it's a lot for them, right? And so that's one of the reasons I like being a fundless sponsor is I'm able to work with a very broad swath of investors and not kind of beholden to a certain LP base.
Right, right. You used the term fundless sponsor. What does that mean?
Yeah. So instead of going out and raising a big fund where I say, hey, this is my plan. This is what my investment thesis is. These are my expected returns.
Right.
Commit some capital today, and then I'll see if I can execute on this plan. What I do is I find a specific investment opportunity. I find a specific building. We source the deal ourselves. We run the deal ourselves. We manage the asset ourselves. And then we raise capital around that one specific opportunity.
Right.
So we don't have a blind pool that we can just execute on. We raise on a specific deal every time.
Right. Now that, yeah, that's interesting. And that's what I think most people are doing is a specific deal raise. I was speaking with someone, I think it was yesterday, and for the first time, and they've raised a lot of money over the years, for the first time, they're actually doing a fund for a variety of reasons. So it's just interesting to see how those different things work out. What are you guys looking to invest in? What's your investment outlook look like for you in 2021?
Yeah. So historically, we've owned a lot of suburban office. And thankfully, that portfolio has held up well. We've been able to make distributions. New leasing is slow, as you would anticipate.
Right.
Lease renewals are fairly muted. But overall, it's fairly well occupied and cash flowing. And we feel really strongly that secondary markets, places like Memphis, places like Nashville, are going to experience growth because of the pandemic and that we can get into it. But we have a whole investment thesis around the continuation of office. But moving forward, we're focused on achieving yield. I mean, we keep it very simple. We try to do three things for our investors. Have a place where they can put capital to work that's uncorrelated to the stock market. Have a place where they can put capital to work that will achieve something close to a double-digit cash-on-cash yield annually. And we take full advantage of all the tax benefits that come from direct real estate ownership. And so for us, again, to use that term fundless sponsor, I really like the ability to go where I find opportunity. So right now we're doing two deals. One is a flex industrial property in Detroit. It's about a 13% cash on cash. And the other one is an early childhood center franchisee. It's a Primrose property in Fort Worth. So we're doing some different things, but we're finding opportunity because of COVID, and we're still trying to achieve that nice, steady, passive income for our investors.
Right. So you guys are investing not just in real estate, but also in active businesses.
No, these are just real assets.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. So the early childhood development is still just an asset.
We're the landlord. That's right. Yeah. Gotcha. There's an operating partner that would be our tenant.
Sure. No. Okay. That's interesting. I want to circle back to the office space discussion because that's been something, you know, people have come out and said, of course, you know, in 2020, you know, office got hammered, of course, hotel, you know, airlines, there were several sectors that really took it on the chin. Mm-hmm. And you said something interesting in that you feel that you're actually going to come out of this, not just with your shirt on, but actually looking pretty good. And you see actually positive hope for that space in the future. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Pre-COVID, 4% of the workforce worked remotely.
Okay.
In a post-COVID world, clearly that's going to be a higher number than 4%. I think we can all agree on that. Now, that being said, this trend that we saw pre-COVID, but after the Great Recession, was towards massive densification, right? The WeWork effect, where everyone was hoteling, hot desking, benching, bullpen, whatever jargon term you want to use, but basically trying to squeeze as many people in to as small a space as possible. Now, regardless of where we are in the vaccine moving forward, the pendulum is going to swing the other way, where we had WeWork locations that had 75 square feet per user in them. In a traditional office layout is more like 350 square feet per employee. So there'll be a return towards traditional office layouts because people have realized they need some peace and quiet to be productive, to get things done. And you'll see offices be more communal, right? Places where people are going to collaborate, be creative, and talk amongst themselves in more kind of larger conference room type setups. Now, that in conjunction with the fact that people are probably going to be working less days in the office than they were pre-COVID, I think it's all going to be, frankly, kind of a wash, right? Where you have the majority of your workforce working 3 days a week in the office. But instead of cramming in as many people as possible, you have more space per employee. I think it's going to be about even, frankly. I don't think it's going to be like retail, which saw this secular decline away from bricks and sticks. I think office will continue to be an important part of our professional lives as we've seen kind of the novelty of work from home wear off. And frankly, we're seeing higher instances of burnout, depression, isolation. Now, there are certain people who work in these companies like engineers or programmers or software folks that maybe can just work from home and just be in the dark closet and do their thing. But if you talk about sales, marketing, C-suite, onboarding new employees, trying to instill a new corporate culture or maintain a corporate culture, I just don't think it's possible to do it, you know, via Zoom.
Right. And at least not in the, in a meaningful way. I would think that that's going to be very challenging moving forward. Have you seen any asset price declines in office space?
So outside of the gateways, and when I say gateway, I mean places like New York City, San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago, to some extent, this, you may not believe me, but I've actually seen pricing be more competitive in the office space post-COVID than it was pre-COVID.
Wow. That is not the answer I was expecting.
Cap rates have gone down. Now, there are esoteric examples, right? I mean, if there's a corporate headquarters that has Delta in it, yeah, it's going to struggle. And, you know, but the office deals that I've seen happen, just because there's so much liquidity in the system and people right. want yield so badly, there's just no way to get income. And there's all, I mean, if you think about, if you're a German sovereign wealth fund and you're getting a negative return on your bonds, you can afford to buy a building in America at a 2% return. It's a good deal for you. Right. So when you think about that ecosystem pushing yields down, depressing cap rates across the spectrum, if it's a decent, well-located office building with you know, good tenancy, it's going to trade at, I think, a lower cap rate than it would have pre-COVID.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. And I'm curious to see how this shakes out once all this money that we've been printing actually gets into the system. It will be, you know, not just from foreign pressure, but also from domestic pressure. You know, what is this going to do to cap rates? And I think that's a great unknown. Yeah, especially,
and,
go ahead.
Yeah, and if you're worried about inflation, which a lot of folks are, you know, real assets are still one of your best hedges against inflation. So we see a lot of folks who are more defensive postured in a 3 to 5 year scale want to deploy capital into real assets, commodities, et cetera.
Right, right. That's fascinating. Brian, let's jump into the final four here. If you were to take everything you know and distill it down to one piece of advice, what would that one piece of advice be?
My piece of advice would be that specific to my experience over the last 10 years, people who get into the commercial real estate business have to understand that not only are they taking a risk on the real estate deals they're doing, but they're also taking a small business risk, starting the company, the infrastructure around those deals. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really underappreciated risk, both from the investor standpoint and from the entrepreneur standpoint.
That's interesting. I'd love to hear more about that at another time. That sounds like a fascinating topic for a later discussion. When it comes to investing in yourself, what's one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
I think my physical health. Pre-COVID, I was taking 100, 150 flights a year, 25 to 35 hotel nights a year, and you know, grinding pretty hard. And post-COVID, I've realized that getting enough sleep, getting more exercise actually makes me more productive, gives me more energy. And so that's something that I'm hopefully going to take with me in a post-COVID world.
Right. No, that's awesome. Yeah, I always say health is wealth. So that, that's absolutely paramount. When it comes to giving back, what's one thing you are doing to make the world a better place?
Yeah, so we partner with a local food bank. It's kind of like Second Harvest, only specific to Nashville. And that's something that, considering everything going on in the world, food security has become a big issue for a lot of folks. And so we're trying to do a small part that we can help our community.
That's awesome. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do we do that?
Yeah, so I'm very active on LinkedIn. You can look me up, Brian C. Adams, Excelsior Capital. Shoot me a note, shoot me a connection request. I'm happy to spend some time on the phone with you. And then if you want to learn more about the investments we're doing, the best way is probably to go to the website, excelsiorgp.com. You can sign up and you'll go through, you know, the typical funnel, and we'll get you kind of squared away and talk more about some of the investment opportunities that we have.
That's awesome. Brian, thanks so much for your time. Certainly appreciate it.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us,
That would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.